Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 7th, 1999, and in Fireside this morning is Barbara Rossing's Bible study, Revelation, How Long, O Lord, Subversive Songs of Saints, number 99-3. Let's listen in.
Okay, my name is Barbara Rossing, and this is the third in a series here looking at the book of Revelation. And today we're going to finally go up into the divine throne room, up to see God sitting on the throne in chapter 4 and chapter 5. I have one of those little Hal Lindsey books. I make it a point to never pay full price for a book by Hal Lindsey because I think he's making far too much money. But I bought one for a quarter called The Rapture. And he starts that book by saying, sort of, what's the central question that we Christians need to face? And he says, in my opinion, the central question we all need to ask is, will the rapture come before the 7-year tribulation period, in the midst of the 7-year tribulation period, or at the end of the 7-year tribulation period and before the 1,000-year millennial reign? And he says, in my opinion, this is the central question that all Christians today need to be asking, because we will live to see the answer to that question. I want to propose to you today that that's not the central question of the book of Revelation. In fact, I mean, as I laid out the first day, and I know that some of you have come and others have left and stuff, but as I laid out the first day, I do not take a literalist kind of approach to the book of Revelation, nor do I think it's written primarily as a set of timetables or predictions of end time events. I don't think we're supposed to read this book as a script for the end time. So that's where I would disagree with Hal Lindsey. I mean, he's setting it up as saying, you know, in my timetable kind of scenario, the central question we all need to be asking is, when's the rapture going to come? Before or after, in the middle of the tribulation? I think rather the central question of the book of Revelation is, whom do you worship? Or to whom do you give your allegiance? We talked about a little bit in the forum last night with the whole sort of patriotism issue and allegiance. But that is the central question of Revelation. The Greek word for worship is this word. I wrote it in the first session here, but it's not very dark. I hope you can see it. It's called proskuneisis. And pros is the Greek preposition that means sort of in front of or towards. Kuneisis has in it the word for knee. So basically what it is, it's bending your knee towards someone. It's falling down and giving allegiance or worshiping. And that's all one word in Greek. Even though in English we have two different words for allegiance and worship, and so we have no trouble, or most mainline Christians that are assimilated to the culture have no trouble saying, oh yes, I can pledge allegiance to my country on the one hand and worship God on the other hand, because they're two different things. Allegiance, pledging allegiance and worshiping are two different things. In Greek, there's not that kind of distinction. It all falls under this word proskuneisis, and it all means giving allegiance to someone. And that, in my opinion, is the central question of Revelation, is to whom do you give allegiance or worship? At a time in the Roman Empire when there was what we call imperial worship or imperial cult worship, which probably was intensifying in Asia Minor at this time. And it took a variety of forms, parades, celebrations, festivities, much as it does in our country, you know, civic religion, but much perhaps more intense bursts of patriotism, because Asia Minor was not located in Italy on the Roman subcontinent or whatever. So in a sense, the elites of Asia Minor wanted to make it even more clear that they were paying allegiance to Rome, that they loved the Roman Empire, even though they were a recently colonized area. They had had their own indigenous cultures. They wanted to pay allegiance to Roman culture and show that this was really the center of their lives. And so people were expected to be willing to worship certainly dead emperors. I mean, the only debate with Revelation is whether Emperor Domitian actually made people worship him during his lifetime or not. But those who were dead, the Caesars, they were all being worshipped. There were temples to Roma and Augustus. throughout Asia Minor. I mean, those of you who have been there have seen those, Jim and Ellen. I mean, you've seen the temples to Roma Augustus. They're nice. I mean, and for a lot of people in the ancient world, it would have been no big deal because you can worship a lot of gods. I mean, it wasn't any problem to add Augustus and the empire into your sort of pantheon of deities that you could worship. It was not a big deal, not a big problem. And paying allegiance to Rome was expected of people. But Revelation says no. And that's what we're going to see now in chapter 4 as we go up into the divine throne room. John is very clear that you can't pay allegiance to Rome and worship God. Those are incompatible. So, and then of course we need to struggle with what that means for us today. Obviously Rome is long gone, you know, just several hundred years after the book was written, finally, Rome was over. And so the question is, what does the book have to say to us today? And what do its calls to worship and its claims about you can't have sort of dual allegiances say to us today? But let's take a look at chapter 4 here. All right, I forgot. I wanted to say one other thing. Excuse me. We talked about how Revelation has a variety of genres going in it. And a literary genre, you know, is a literary type of writing. I can't make this any darker, but genre. And then it's got at least three genres: prophecy. We talked about that's Old Testament prophecy, not prediction of events. Apocalypse, that's this genre where someone goes on a journey up into heaven or down into the underworld, out into the future, back into the past. That's what we're going to see happen now in chapter 4. This is where the apocalyptic journey starts. And letters is what we talked about yesterday. So in a sense, if you sort of plot out the book of Revelation, what you've got for chapters 1 through 3 here is earth, and setting it all up in the situation in Asia Minor. Then in chapter 4, John goes up into heaven, and from now the songs are going to start. Because all the singing in Revelation, which is so central to the book, this takes place in heaven as kind of a commentary on events of earth. So in chapters 4 and 5, we're going to get a lot of songs. You're going to recognize these songs. You might say, like so many Lutherans do, oh, I don't know a thing about the book of Revelation, but actually you know the songs. You've been singing them a long time. It's holy, holy, holy. It's the hallelujah chorus from Handel's Messiah. It's worthy as the Lamb. We just sang it on Sunday. I mean, you know these songs. You'll recognize this throne room scene. Okay, so now we're about to start the journey of the apocalypse. Would someone read chapter 4, verses 1 through, well, we could read the whole chapter, but let's just do 1 through 6 here. And then somebody else can read till the end of the chapter. How's that? Somebody read 1 through 6 and somebody else 7 till the end. How's that?
And after this I looked, and lo, in heaven an open door. And the first voice which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, come up hither, and I will show you what must take place after this. At once I was in the spirit, and lo, a throne stood in heaven with one seated on the throne. And he who sat there appeared like a jasper, and carnelian.
Yeah, I don't know. Dorothy Bennett would know what this is. What is a carnelian? Is it a? Yeah. What kind is it? Is it pink?
It's a semi-precious stone.
Semi-precious. See, I should know this. I majored in geology, and I can't remember.
And round the throne was a rainbow that looked like an emerald. Round the throne were 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones were 24 elders, clad in white garments, with golden crowns upon their heads. From the throne issues flashes of lightning, and voices and peals of thunder. And before the throne burn 7 torches of fire, which are the 7 spirits of God. And before the throne there is, as it were, a sea of glass like crystal.
Somebody want to take us to the end here?
Around the throne, and on each side of the throne, are 4 living creatures, 4 eyes in front and behind. The first living creature, like a lion. The second living creature, like an ox. The third living creature, with a face like a human face. And the fourth living creature, like a flying eagle. And the 4 living creatures, each of them with 6 wings, are full of eyes all around and inside. Day and night, without ceasing, they sing, holy, 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 the Lord God, the Almighty, who was and is to come. And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to the one who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before the one who is seated on the throne and worship the one who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, singing, "You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created."
Thank you. Okay, so you know some of these songs, right? You know, casting down their golden crowns upon the glass. You see that? Was it from Holy, Holy, Holy? Taking our crowns off, throwing them down. The worthy are you, the holy, holy. You recognize this stuff. This is what happens up in heaven, bursting into song, praising God, the one who sits upon the throne. And, you know, it's kind of like a gemstone tour of all the precious stones up there. It's this beautiful vision. It draws on the Old Testament. There's a throne room scene like this in Ezekiel that certainly shapes this one. I mean, God's throne room is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so Ezekiel wrote about it. John is invoking that tradition now in this description that he sees. It also draws on Isaiah with these winged creatures and stuff. It's very much a traditional biblical vision. I want to say one other thing about it, though, and this is from a scholar, a Roman Catholic scholar who's in Chicago, now moving to Notre Dame, I think. His name is David Auna, and he wrote this in 1983, but it's now become very widely accepted among scholars. And this is what he says about Revelation 4. "The thesis of this paper is that John's description of the heavenly ceremonial practiced in the throne room of God," that's all this, you know, throwing down these crowns, singing the songs, the torches, the everything that we just saw here, "that this scene bears such a striking resemblance to the ceremonial of the imperial court and the imperial cult that it can only be understood as a parody of the former." So what he's saying, basically, in this paper, I mean, then he develops the thesis, is that even though John is writing in Asia Minor, you know, over in Turkey, here, I'll draw it this way, and Rome is located in Italy, and not very many people actually went to visit the emperor in Rome. Certainly John hadn't. And just like most of us have not been to visit Queen Elizabeth. You know, has anyone in this room ever had an audience with Queen Elizabeth? No. Okay, but we sort of have an idea what we'd do if we were going to go there and have one. And we you know, walk up the steps of Buckingham Palace. Actually, I don't know what we'd do, but I would curtsy and some others would bow, you know. And you have a sense of what it would be like. That's basically Auna's argument here, is that the scene of Revelation 4, yes, it draws on the Old Testament. Yes, it's what John sees in a vision. But it also is meant to be seen by people as a conscious parody or trumping of the imperial throne room located in Rome where you'd go to visit the emperor. And so basically what John is doing in this vision, what we're seeing here, is the counter question to who's the true emperor who rules the world? Where is the true throne room that holds all the controls for earth located? And at that time, you would have said it was located in Rome, basically. I mean, Rome, after the Battle of Actium, which we just saw on TV a few weeks ago with that Cleopatra miniseries. How many of you saw that?
Yeah.
Anybody? Am I the only one that watched that? You're kidding me. Oh, my gosh. Okay, good. I know others of you watched that. Somebody else, please. No? Oh, wow. Okay, well, good for you.
Star in my crown.
Yeah, it was pretty bad, right?
It was.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, you know, after the intrigue of Octavian and Mark Antony fighting it out, you know, for who's going to rule the provinces of, you know, Egypt and stuff, then Octavian won. And then he ruled the whole world, basically. And so from that point on, the throne room in Rome was what operated the whole world empire. Everything in the known inhabited world had been conquered by Rome. And the emperor was the one who had his finger on the button and controlled everything. And so logically, if you asked who is in charge of the universe, the question would be the Roman emperor. He runs it all. And he's divine or quasi-divine, or he's going to be divine the minute he dies. And that would have been understood. So this throne room scene undercuts that whole notion. Because what's being written here is, where is the true throne located from which the ruler of the universe rules? It's not in Rome. It's in heaven. And where are the true liturgies to be found? I mean, if you went to visit the emperor in Rome, apparently there would be torches there. There would be living creatures. There would be jewels on this throne. There would be all kinds of liturgies, you know, a whole retinue of sacristans and various acolytes, you know, would be lighting torches and would be bowing and scraping and, you know, paying allegiance. There would be a whole sort of ritual and liturgy that you'd go through. And what John is saying here is, no, that's not where true liturgy is to be found. True worship of the one who rules the universe is to be found in heaven. And the ruler of the universe is not the Roman Empire, it's God. God is the one who truly sits on the throne and is worthy of praise and honor and blessing and glory and might and power. So it's kind of an amazing sort of trumping scene that happens here. You know, it's like as if you're saying, oh, you've got a nice throne with some jewels on it in Rome. Well, we've got a better throne up in heaven, a bigger, better, more bejeweled throne. And it's really saying to Christians who are, you know, somewhat beleaguered living under this empire, who don't know kind of where to turn, because it looks like in order to buy and sell things, you've got to pay allegiance to Rome. You've got to use the coinage of the empire. You know, it's, you have to participate. It seems like you've got to go along, even if you don't really believe in it. John is saying, no, you don't, because your true allegiance does not belong to Rome and its coinage and its economy. You don't have to participate in those liturgies. Rather, your true allegiance belongs to God in heaven, who sits on the throne. That's what this scene does. It's a profoundly sort of political vision in that sense of saying where allegiance is owed and where true power belongs. It's really undercutting the claims of the Roman Empire, according to David Auna here. And I think his thesis has been so widely accepted now among scholars that, and it rings true with me. I don't know, why don't I throw it open here to any of you? Does anybody have any response to that?
Would these songs have been sung in the church, in the early church?
Well, actually, that's a big debate among scholars. That's a good question. He thinks it's more likely that these are the kinds of songs that would have been sung in Rome. That they were singing holy holies to the emperor and that kind of thing. And these songs like, worthy are you to receive blessing and honor and glory and might. I mean, maybe somehow somebody had gotten the lyrics to some of the liturgies that you were singing in Rome, and that this is the kind of thing. So his thesis is, I mean, he says, even though people have said, in interpreting the throne room ceremonial of the apocalypse as an idealized projection of imperial court ceremonial, I must reject the widely held notion that the heavenly liturgy of the apocalypse is a projection of the liturgy of the earthly church. So he says they weren't singing it up until this point. Now, obviously, now we do sing it. But he's saying these songs are much more sort of political than they were Eucharistic, or and they weren't so much Christian as they were pagan. And then John is using them, you know, just like Martin Luther was using barroom songs and stuff to sing about a mighty fortress, or, you know, that John is using the secular songs to sort of undercut the secular worship and instead direct our worship to heaven.
And I wasn't at your first session, so maybe you've already touched this, but John was away from the Christians when he wrote this.
Uh-huh.
And the Christians were under persecution, and so he had to write in terms so that if his letters were going to be received outside of the Christians, that the Christians wouldn't be persecuted. So he was writing in the language of the people that were giving allegiance to the Romans. But on the other hand, the Christians would understand that he was not talking about the government or the political situation, but a spiritual.
Yeah, it's a really tough issue. And that's certainly what I was taught in seminary, is that it was a situation of persecution. And this was a kind of code language to get under the radar screen of the Romans. Actually, though, that too is being challenged now by scholars who, or by historians, is where it comes from. We have a classicist here. Where are you? Help me out. Okay. Where basically what historians say is, well, in actual fact, we have no documented persecution under the time of Domitian. There had been under Nero. there was, say, 50 years later, a little bit under Antoninus Pius and others, but there, at the time of Domitian, it doesn't seem like Christians were being killed or persecuted. Now, certainly memory is a persecution. I mean, well, Laura, you can talk about how, you know, even though World War II was 50 years ago, the memories of communist oppression certainly stay with one whose relatives were oppressed. So it might be the memory of the Nero persecution, but we don't think there was any out-and-out sort of persecution or killing of people. Sorry to put you on the spot, Laura. But, you know, at this time.
But they certainly were, if they didn't pay allegiance, they were... It was hard for them to find
a job. Right. And I think it's more this economic kind of marginalization. Yes, that they didn't pay allegiance. But I also would say the idea that Revelation is written in code language is now being kind of challenged as well. When we see how many other apocalypses. In fact, you've got a Bible there. You have the Revised Standard with the Apocrypha that has 2 Esdras in it. You look at that. That's an example of another apocalypse, 2 Esdras or others. And you see how widespread these apocalypses were that are using exactly the same language. And you realize, well, if it was code language, they sure shared their code books pretty widely. Because everybody would have known this language and imagery. It wasn't as codified as we think it is. I mean, it's we now who can't understand it because we don't have apocalypses anymore. But they had a lot of them back then, and it was pretty common language. But, yeah, I mean, that's certainly been the prevailing view. And that you could still have that view. I mean, it's disputed how to interpret Revelation. It's hard to know. But the historians will tell us there was not persecution, although there was certainly marginalization of people. And not just of Christians, but also of Jews, also of anyone that held to a religion that said they couldn't also participate in the imperial system. Because Rome just wanted people to go along. Anybody else? Okay, well, let's continue with chapter 5. There's going to be more singing. We're going to meet a new character in chapter 5, the central figure of the book here. After all this singing in heaven and everything, would somebody read chapter 5, verses 1 through 5?
And I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I wept much that no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, "Weep not. Lo, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its 7 seals."
Okay. This is sort of vintage apocalyptic language. If it turns into a rainy day today, then maybe you want to hole up in the library and read 2 Esdras or another apocalypse. I mean, any of our Bibles in the library that have the Apocrypha would have it. And you'll read through these apocalypses. I've got a whole list of other ones that were Jewish apocalypses written at this time. Oh, the Book of Enoch. This is an interesting one because some scholars, American historians, say it's based on the apocalypse called Enoch, that Christopher Columbus thought there was a new world out there to discover. And so he sailed off. He got permission from Spain on the basis of a verse in the Book of Enoch. I mean, they even in the Middle Ages, they knew these apocalypses better than we do. We don't know the Apocrypha as well. And there were a lot of other apocalypses out there. But anyway, the idea of having something be sealed up, this is just sort of common apocalyptic stuff. You find it in the Book of Daniel. And usually things are sealed up not to be opened for a while. So Revelation is a little different in saying that the seals are going to be opened. The idea of bringing in big, strong animals with mighty claws to open things that mortals are unable to open, that also is vintage apocalyptic. There are a lot of animals in apocalypses, typically. That's one reason I like them. Talking animals, even. You know, it's like Charlotte's Web, only better. And these are classically sort of hybrid animals that don't exactly exist. You know, they might have more than one heads or horns or eyes. And they certainly have claws, great wings sometimes. In 2 Esdras, there's an eagle that transports people around when they're in danger. There's a bear in there. But it's usually these clawed characters. But what we're going to see here in chapter 5, I think it's really important to use the categories of genre to help understand Revelation. But then look where John makes changes. Look where it doesn't follow the patterns, because that too can be important. In a sense, Revelation is a genre-bending book, because there's points at which I think even with a sense of humor, he changes the patterns and sort of shocks or surprises us. And people in the ancient world would have recognized this because they knew the patterns. In a sense, that's where you most want to zero in on and see what he's saying there, because when someone breaks the pattern, then you really see what their particular angle theologically is. I mean, we call in New Testament studies, we sometimes call this redaction criticism, where you see how someone changes their sources or changes the pattern. And that's what we're going to see right here, because he sets us up. He says, you know, we got to get these scrolls open. They're all sealed up. Who's going to be worthy to open the scrolls? People try. They're not able to. Okay, bring in an animal. Who are you going to bring in? You're going to bring in the lion of the tribe of Judah. Okay, no surprise. That's to be expected. Great claws. He's going to claw open these seals. But what do we see instead? Would someone be willing to read verse 6 and 7?
And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went out, and he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne.
Okay. So we don't get a lion, we get a lamb. It's like the month of March, right? I mean, you're expecting this apocalyptic lion, and instead what you get is what our friend Dan Erlander teaches up here calls fluffy. You get this little lamb. And the Greek word for lamb isn't even the regular word for lamb like is used in the Gospel of John, you know, where John the Baptist points to Jesus and says, "Behold the Lamb of God." That's the word amnos. This case, it's this little word for lamb. It's arneon. And anytime in Greek when you put this eon suffix on something, it's the diminutive. It means the little one. You could put it on things. It's like in German, you know, where if you put C-H-E-N on something, shin, like Mädchen, then it's like a little, it's the diminutive. So this lamb, I mean, he's pointing out that it's a vulnerable little lamb, an arneon. Also, when you put that suffix on anything, then it makes the gender of that noun neuter. It's not masculine or feminine anymore, it becomes neuter. So in fact, the lamb is an it here, which is interesting. Little aside there. But anyway, this is the principal image for Jesus Christ in the book of Revelation, is this lamb, little lamb who has been slain, who's standing there. And this is where John really breaks the pattern of an apocalypse. There's no other apocalypse in all the Apocrypha, in all the ancient world, that has a lamb figure like this. This is completely original to the book of Revelation. This is unknown up to this point. And now this lamb is going to become the central character of Revelation. This lamb, the vulnerable, fluffy, who has been slain, who is Jesus Christ, who is worthy to open the seals. He's the one who's going to become the hero of this book. And we talked yesterday about why Jesus is portrayed as a lamb, because obviously this is metaphorical. You know, this is an example of how you've got to read Revelation metaphorically, not literally, since we know that Jesus was not literally a sheep. He was a person. But to speak of him as a lamb in that metaphor means that you're calling to mind recollections of the Exodus traditions, of the Passover lamb, of Isaiah 53, and the whole tradition of that lamb who gives his life for us. So it's a metaphor, it's an image, but it's a very, very powerful one, very Christological, very Christ-centered. So the lamb goes and takes the scroll, and when he had taken the scroll, more singing. Everyone bursts into song. The lamb gets a harp. They're all singing, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain. By your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and tongue and nation." Verse 10. Take a look at verse 10.
Can you say something about the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth? And it's a slain lamb, yet with seven horns, seven eyes, and then it identifies the seven horns and seven eyes with the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth.
Yeah.
Do you have a clue what that is?
No, I don't. Somebody was saying that Walter Wink has a theory on this, and I need to look at that. No, I don't.
Seven spirits of God?
Huh.
Okay.
I don't know.
Is seven a complete number?
Yeah, seven is the perfect number. I mean, everything comes in sevens that's good.
Yeah.
But seven spirits. No, I don't know.
Okay.
But that's why we're starting this on July 7th.
Is it July 7th today? Yeah, that must be it. That's it. But we're using the Roman calendar then, so, yeah. The month that's named after Julius Caesar. What?
Which is the 7th.
Oh, it is the 7th month. Oh, my gosh. So it's 7-7. So. Okay. All right. Yeah, I don't know about those seven spirits. Sorry. Okay, so worthy are you. You have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on earth. This is one thing I love about the book of Revelation. This and 1 Peter are the books of the New Testament on which Martin Luther based his really important doctrine of the priesthood of all believers, which I think we really need to continue to lift up, this idea that all the people of God are priests. It's based in the Old Testament, Exodus 19, verse 6. Other strands in the Old Testament as well. Now, obviously, the priestly writer in the Old Testament, you know who we call P, would never agree with this. The only Levitical priests are really priests, or Zadokite priests. I mean, there are sort of dueling visions of who's a priest even in the Old Testament, and certainly in the New Testament. The Hebrews probably wouldn't agree with this. In the book of Hebrews, only Jesus is a priest. But here in Revelation, it's this wonderful idea, and it's repeated in chapter 1, then here in, I think it's 1:10 or 1:6, then here in chapter 5. We'll see it again in chapter 20, the millennium vision. I want to talk about that tomorrow, because I think we really need to pick up this notion. But here it is. All of God's people will be priests, and they shall reign on earth. I mean, that's kind of a political statement right there, because who reigns on earth right now is the emperor, but this idea that God's people reign on earth. And then I looked, and behold, more living creatures, myriads and myriads, thousands of thousands, all singing with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And then more singing, more clanking of crowns, it's what Dan Erlander says, take the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, or the best choir you know, maybe it's the Luther Choir, or the St. Olaf Choir, or whatever, yes, okay, it's not the Carlton Choir, but take the best choir you know, and bring in the San Diego Zoo, or the best zoo you know. If you think your zoo is better than the San Diego Zoo, he thinks the San Diego Zoo is the best. And then throw crowns all around, clanking, clanking. And that's what you've got going on in this heavenly worship scene. It's a cacophony of animals and people all falling down before the throne of God and the Lamb and praising and singing. It's an extraordinary vision. And this throughout the book now, we're going to see singing breaking out frequently as we read through it. Because now that we've got heaven and earth running as these two layers at the same time, the singing takes place in heaven. It's kind of a commentary about what takes place on earth. I want to just read an excerpt here from a book that I'm going to try to put on reserve. I need to meet the librarian, because now I've got three books I want on reserve. But anyway, if anybody knows the librarian, help me find her. This one called Comfort and Protest, The Apocalypse from a South African Perspective. It's now out of print, but it's in our library, and it's a wonderful book by Ellen Bozak, reading the book of Revelation in one hand and the South African situation of the 1980s in the other hand. And obviously it's a little out of date now, because thanks be to God there's a new government in South Africa. But I think this is a window into how the book of Revelation speaks to marginalized people, as does Pablo Richard's book from Chile that I'm using as a primary text here. So let me just read, I've got it photocopied here because I'm marking the passages, from Bozak about this scene, about Revelation 5, this worship of the Lamb. It's pretty wonderful. He writes, "It is a wonder that the 24 elders and the thousands around the throne are not struck dumb with wonder, but they break out in joy, singing a new song. It is a song of jubilation and of newfound certainty. They know the strife is not over yet. The battle is only about to begin. Deep valleys of pain and suffering lie ahead, and God's people are still in the midst of the struggle, yet they sing. It is a joyful song of victory. Worthy are you, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed children for God from every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and they shall reign on earth. They shall reign on earth, these little people, lowly and destitute though they may be. They shall reign on earth. Caesar's reign is coming to an end. His oppression has its limits. His time is over, and then they shall reign on earth. Only a little while. This joyful singing frightens the oppressor. Black people in South Africa have made freedom songs part of the struggle. In fact, the struggle is inconceivable without singing. Marching down the streets, facing the police and army troops of the South African government, we sing. In jail, we sing songs of defiance and faith and freedom. It makes the jailers nervous. In prison, singing is not allowed. And Nelson Mandela writes about that in his autobiography on Robben Island, too. They weren't allowed to sing for 25 years or whatever it was. He couldn't sing, but they did. Singing is not allowed, but political prisoners sing anyway. Their voices blending as the song is picked up from cell to cell until the prison resounds with music that celebrates the coming victory. Prison wardens, policemen, and heavily armed soldiers cannot understand how people can sing under such circumstances. So we've learned another valuable lesson. The joy of the oppressed is a source of fear for the oppressor. But we sing because we believe. We sing because we have hope. We sing because we know that it is only a little while and the tyrant shall cease to exist. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. On a Sunday afternoon, young black Christians pick up this ancient song and make of it a new song as they dance around a police vehicle just after a student has been arrested at our church service. Amandla, Simswa Bisile, Alleluia, Usatani, Alleluia. Translated, it goes something like this. It is broken, the power of Satan is broken. We have disappointed Satan, Alleluia. As we sing, the song is picked up by others. The police, somewhat confused, somewhat bewildered, somewhat scared, release our friend. Others join us as we march, singing and dancing back into the church. This is a new song, a freedom song. And the power of it, the sheer joy of it, the amazing truth in it, captivate and inspire thousands upon thousands throughout South Africa. For although the seals of the scroll must still be opened, the scroll is not in the hands of Caesar, but in the hands of the Lamb. And we will sing this new song until every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all therein will say, to the one who sits upon the throne and to the Lamb, be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever. Amandla Usatani, Alleluia. So that's the power of singing. And what I love about that, I mean, I'm sure, is the old song becomes the new song, and how the singing itself gives hope and empowerment to people. Comments? I know a lot of you have been in South Africa. Heard
it
the singing.
Reminds me of the song, How Can I Keep From Singing?
Uh-huh.
And in that, even in the dungeon, you have to sing.
Yeah, and I think that's what's going on in Revelation, is that the songs are meant to give hope, even though things are going to get worse on earth, and they are. We're going to launch now into the middle section of Revelation, the most terrible. We're going to go quick through it. But it's the songs in heaven are meant to be sort of this this encouragement to people to continue to persevere, and it's the vision of God's reign. It's the heavenly commentary on what transpires on earth, and it's this reminder to people that you're true one that you worship is God, that God is the one who sits on the throne, and you don't have to worship Caesar. This power is only going to last a little longer, whatever the oppressive power, whatever reality is. I mean, in a sense, how many of you have seen the movie Truman Show? If you didn't watch Cleopatra, were you at least going to Truman Show? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Revelation is somewhat like that in the sense of saying we live in this world that purports to be reality, you know, and it seems to be a happy, affluent world. And the idea of Revelation is there's an other reality out there. There's a different way of seeing reality. I mean, I don't think the analogy is complete there. But the idea that things can look so pleasant and wonderful, and yet this isn't the end all and be all that it purports to be. I mean, there's something else. The book of Revelation is trying to give you the courage to walk through that curtain, to walk through that membrane out into reality and to see reality a different way. And that's what Revelation does, is give us a world of vision, a different way of seeing this world in the eyes of God as the true ruler of the universe. All right, let's start into the middle sections here. If you hate the book of Revelation, it's probably because of the middle. The seals, the trumpets, the bowls, the plagues that go on, the scary stuff, the violence, the horses, the bugs, the creatures. This is what, certainly, I mean, I'll just say this is what I find the most intimidating about Revelation. This is where the fundamentalists or millenarians or... that word always sounds like hat makers to me, millenarians, but anyway, millennialists, whatever, really go to town. Because if you're going to read Revelation as a script for end time events, then you'll try to say that it's going to happen, you know, first there will be the seals, then there will be the trumpets, then there will be the bowls. It's all a script. All you have to do is look around us. You see it's getting hotter and hotter. Did you everybody realize out there it's almost 100 degrees wherever you live, at least where I live. It's hotter than ever. This is all the plagues of the end times. You know, the world is heating up. It's all going to hell in a handbasket, just like the script says in the book of Revelation. And you play it out as a script predicting end time events. Now, I'm going to argue that I don't think that's how we're to read this middle section, nor do I think the middle section permits being read by like that, but certainly you can, and many do in our culture. I don't think that's the primary intent. But it's a difficult section to get through the middle, the seals, the trumpets, the bowls. So here's some strategies that I want to suggest to you. First of all, don't try to figure out each image. It's only since the Reformation and the printing press that we have the luxury of each person in this room sitting here with a Bible of your own. Before that, when Revelation was written, and for the first 1,500 years of the Bible's existence, a congregation was lucky if it had one copy of the Bible, and someone would read it out loud, and everybody else would listen. So in a sense, I mean, even though I'm a Protestant and I'm so glad we each own our own Bibles, and you know, most of us probably own 5 or 10 or 20 or however many, and it's good to own your own Bible. What this means, the downside of it is, it's like owning a VCR. You know, before VCRs, when TV shows were on, you know, they just played away. And if you didn't get something, you couldn't say, oh, wait, let's stop it there. Let's, you know, go back. Let's reverse. Let's go back. You know, look at that scene. Like, you know, stop right there. And then you'd go on to the next one. You could figure each scene out. Before that, it just played on. And that's how Revelation was meant to be. So that this middle section, even though you could spend a lifetime, and many do, you know, especially psychologically, you know, different kinds of people spend a lot of time. I don't know what to say. You know, it's a treasure trove, and you could spend a lot of time in the middle section of Revelation. If you were an early Christian, and indeed, the opening verses of the book say, blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of the prophecy, and blessed are those who hear. It's meant to be read aloud. If you were an early Christian, it would take about an hour for this middle section, because the whole book takes about 2 hours, but it would keep on going. And I doubt if you would have the audacity to say to the reader, you know, let's stop with each of those images. Let's spend a week on each of those beasts, you know, and figure them all out. No, it plays on. It keeps going. You don't have time to, and my colleague David Rhodes in New Testament has the book of Revelation memorized, if you can believe it. And he performs it. He recites it. And he does that for my classes each time, and it just keeps on going. So, yeah, this middle section, there's a lot of images there, but you don't have time to puzzle each one out. So don't stop it. Just keep on going. So that's the first strategy, and don't try to figure out each image. Second strategy is recognize the pattern that's being used here, which is the pattern of the Exodus. the plagues that happen in Revelation, especially with the trumpets and the bowls, these are meant to trigger your memories of the Exodus. Because what kinds of things happen with the Exodus plagues? I mean, you know these. You got your grasshoppers, your locusts, what else?
Boils.
Frogs, gnats. Yeah, water turning to blood. Yeah, firstborn, that's the last one, uh-huh. This kind of stuff, it's going to happen in Revelation, and what it's meant to remind you of is the Exodus. And this is where I think Pablo Richard's commentary is so good, is he interprets Revelation as a kind of new Exodus story. Just as Moses brought the people out of bondage in Egypt, so now God is calling us out of slavery in Rome, whatever that means. And the call in Revelation 18 is very clear to come out. This is a new Exodus. God's people are being brought from captivity to freedom. And just as plagues and terrible sort of natural disasters were part of that shaking loose the allegiance and the grasp of Pharaoh in the Old Testament story, so now those same kinds of things are part of what's going on in bringing God's people from captivity to liberation in the book of Revelation. And it's meant to remind you of the Exodus story. It's invoking imagery of the Exodus story here. So a lot of the stuff that sounds like terrible judgment, and if you play it as a script for end time events, then it's meant to scare you a lot. A lot of this is the same kind of stuff that we saw happening in the Old Testament book of Exodus. And where you see that most clearly with Revelation, if you turn to chapter 15, this is where it's made explicit, I think. This is at the beginning of the bowls vision. So after the seals and after the trumpets and the middle stuff, then before the bowls, in chapter 15, then I saw another sign in heaven, great and wonderful, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last. These are the bowl angels, are the ones who are going to pour out the bowls. With them, the wrath of God has ended. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who had conquered the beast in its image and the number of its name standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. And then it's another one of these wonderful songs. But here, the connection between Moses and the Lamb then is made explicit. Just as Moses brought the people of Israel out of Egypt, so now the Lamb, Jesus Christ, is bringing the people of God out of Rome, out of captivity in Babylon, and into God's new Jerusalem. This is the link here between Moses and the Lamb that I think we're supposed to see throughout the trumpets and the bowls as we see this scary apocalyptic imagery. It's Exodus imagery. The water's turning to blood. A lot of the same kinds of things happen. There's certainly differences. How many plagues were there in Egypt?
Ten.
And in Revelation, it's seven. So the number is different, but it's still the same kinds of things that happen. That's at least Richard's suggestions and the suggestion of others. Elizabeth Schisler Fiorenza, who was my advisor, also says there's a lot of Exodus imagery in Revelation, even though there's differences. So that's the second strategy. First strategy, read fast and keep going and don't figure everything out. Second strategy, read it with the story of Exodus in mind. Third strategy is notice the salvation interludes. And we're going to take a look at that now. Let's look at the seals vision. So back to chapter 6. I can't even say the seals without thinking of the 4th of July prayer, but anyway. It's the other kind of seals in Revelation.
What did you say the strategy is
here? Notice the interludes.
Interludes.
The salvation interludes. Okay, so, oops, I was supposed to allow discussion. All right, we're going to do the fastest reading of the seven seals here that you ever saw, and then we'll have, like, a couple minutes for discussion. Okay, the seals are open. Boom, boom, boom. The four horsemen come out. You know this. This is the Notre Dame backfield, right? And what are their names? Who knows? Anyway, the four horsemen of the apocalypse apparently were the, Jim, you would know this, wouldn't you? The Notre Dame football?
Oh, the real names of the
yeah.
names?
Yeah. Who were the four horsemen?
Bronco Nagurski.
I don't remember.
Well, anyway, they all had names, and each was one of these horses. So that's what these mean, of course. That takes care of four. We had these at the 4th of July parade. No, each of these is open, and a horse and a rider comes out. a lot of this is conventional imagery of apocalypses, although the third one is very interesting because this seems to be, it's a little longer than the others, and it seems to be a comment on the Roman economic situation in Asia Minor where cash cropping was being encouraged at the expense of subsistence crops that people needed. But anyway, the fifth seal is open. The people cry out from under the altar, "How long, O Lord?" And again, I mean, I'm reading this in a particular way as saying it's not so much about how long, O Lord, before the end of the world comes. It's how long, O Lord, before the end of Roman rule comes. A lot of the end time sounding stuff of Revelation, or what we call eschatology about the end, is this question of when will Rome end? And the just a little longer is meant to be hopeful and reassuring, not scary to people. It's the hope that only a little while longer will oppression continue under this rule. Then the sixth seal opens. This is very much apocalyptic convention stuff, verses 12 through 17. And then the seventh seal in verse 18, right? Take a look at verse 18. Okay, good. You don't have a verse 18, right? No, this is the interlude, okay? This is where the pattern is broken. You don't get unrelenting series of sevens in the book of Revelation. You get the first six seals opened, and then there's a pause. Then there's an interlude. There is no verse 18. After the sixth seal, what you get instead is chapter 7, a whole new thing. And this is where you see the pattern most clearly, that what John is doing here is giving us not just unrelenting judgment, but rather interludes of salvation that are meant to reassure us and to renew our hope. Chapter 7 is where this whole multitude of people is sealed, the 144,000, but we're not to take that literally, because in verse 9 it says, "After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count." So it's big and huge. It includes all of us. It's all God's people. This is a reminder that even in the midst of the judgment, the plagues, the scary stuff, we've got salvation. We have the hope of Christ Jesus. And that's what chapter 7 is a huge and wonderful salvation interlude here, which I assume many of us want read at our funerals. I mean, it's just beautiful. This is where you get them. They're dressed in white robes, waving their palm branches, singing the songs. And it's just lovely. Verse 15, "They are before the throne of God, serve God day and night. The one who sits on the throne will shelter them." It's a beautiful image. "They shall not hunger nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd and will guide them to springs of living water. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." It's beautiful. And only then do you get the seventh seal. Chapter 8, see, that's where the seventh seal is open. But you've got this huge interlude between the sixth and the seventh, and it's salvation. It's not more judgment, unrelenting judgment, it's salvation. And this is, Elizabeth Schisler Fiorenza argues, I guess I could put this book on reserve too. Where is it? That this is the pattern with all the sevens, is that we always get this kind of salvation interlude. In fact, she argues that the millennium vision is another one of these interludes. So notice this pattern. Okay, we've got a few minutes here for discussion. I'll give you a few more strategies tomorrow, but those are suggestions that I have for getting through the middle section and on to the Babylon vision and the New Jerusalem vision, my favorites here.
So the middle section goes through 17.
Well, yes, okay, it's a big middle section. That's the weak point in my argument. It's a very large middle section, chapters 6 through 16.
Can I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
Even if we follow all of these strategies, how can we keep from leaving the book with the impression that it's fine that we have a lamb who's vulnerable and invites us into a path of gentleness and even nonviolence, but that's only because the lamb is backed up by enormous power and violence. I mean, in other words, these scorpions had come down and tortured people for 5 months, and they long for death, but death won't come. Just make Steven Spielberg look innocent and contriving creatures of mass destruction. So, I mean, we're left with some of the images that are in the Old Testament of a God who is enormously violent, and that's sort of what backs up, in a way, the lamb. And is that sort of Is there a way that we can keep from getting that impression that finally what warrants nonviolence is unimaginable vengeance?
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's all the buildup. I guess what you have to say is read as Schuster Fiorenza does, which is that all of this is intended not as sort of prediction or backup, but as exhortation so that it won't happen. That sense of exhortation there, she argues very strongly. The other thing is that the actual battles are not narrated in the Book of Revelation. You notice that especially in chapter 19. I mean, there's all the getting ready for the battle, and then there's the aftermath of the battle, but the battle itself isn't there. It's left out. And so there are several Mennonite scholars, a guy named Clausen and others, who argue that, in fact, the book is nonviolent, and I see their point. So I would say that it has a veneer of violence but actually is never used or something. I don't know. But I agree with you. That's the dilemma. And Schuster Fiorenza says this is the Achilles heel of Revelation, too, that it's that ultimately what it does is cast the world in imperial terms. It's just that God is now the emperor. But to marginalize people who are living under an oppressive political situation, it really does bring hope. The problem is when it's people in power who actually have the armies, the chariots, the powers, the weapons, are reading it, namely us, that then it becomes a possible mandate for violence, and that's what's really scary about this book. No, I agree with you. It's
I had the unpleasant sensation from time to time reading this that it was a source of comfort to the martyrs to think that though they have suffered, boy, when these people get around to suffering, theirs is going to just be a whole lot worse. I mean, those scorpions are going to inflict such pain. That, and it kind of worries me, that kind of rhetorical appeal feeds into the darker angels of our nature.
Yeah, no, definitely.
That was my question. What's the connection between Jesus in the Gospels and Revelation, besides the image of the Lamb? I don't see. I mean, the Book of Life and you'll be judged by the good works you've done. The Gospel. I don't see the Gospel.
Well, see what you think on Friday after we look at the New Jerusalem vision. I think the New Jerusalem is a really wonderful vision of our future in God's hands. And the Gospels also have apocalyptic sections. I mean, you look at Mark chapter 13, it sounds a little bit like this, and the other Gospels as well. So, you know, I don't know how far one can use literary genre except to just say this stuff that sounds the most violent, scary, that's the convention. That's the literary convention. John breaks the pattern when he's a little less violent and stuff, but this is, it's sort of like if you have a macro on your computer and you just press Alt-A for apocalypse, and up on your screen comes a sort of apocalypse. It would have all this stuff in it. And then, you know, you can vary it or something. But it is troublesome, of course. That's why I'm saying read fast through the middle. I mean, this is, if you can get from chapter 6 to 16 without getting bogged down, then you'll be in good shape. But it's there. It's definitely there.
I'm just curious, when you're saying that really what it was about was less predicting the end of the world or predicting at all as much as hoping for the end of Rome and the Roman Empire, for how long is the Book of Revelation? I mean, has it just been our sort of post-war years that the Book of Revelation has been seen as a prediction of the end of the world somehow? And I'd love to know a little bit about that. And then any speculation you have, is it the bomb? Has it been environmental issues? I mean, what is it that makes, you know, fundamentalists among ourselves and even non-Christians really take to this with such excitement and energy? And is that, so I guess that's a two-pronged question.
Okay, I didn't bring it today, but the book that I've found most helpful on that is this book by Paul Boyer called When Time Shall Be No More. And that one is on reserve in the library. Prophecy, Belief in American Culture. I don't know if it's also in the bookstore, but I think Mark ordered it.
I didn't check yesterday. I don't know if it's arrived or not.
Yeah, I didn't see it. It's enormously helpful to me. And basically, yes, this reading of Revelation started in the 19th century, if you can believe it, with Charles Darby, with the Scofield Reference Bible. It swept across the American prairies, and it has become the dominant American reading of the apocalypse. But it's recent, and it's somewhat idiosyncratic to us as Americans. It's new. essentially, even though, I mean, we looked at Martin Luther yesterday, and yeah, he was reading Revelation in a sense this way, but not as this kind of script for the end times where you lay it, where you combine it, where you stitch together the so-called rapture text from 1 Thessalonians 4, and you put it together with a little bit from the Gospels, you know, two women will be in the field, one will be taken, one will be left, or whatever, and then you write, you stitch that together with Revelation 20. This whole sort of script reading where you've got it all kind of figured out as this chronology that actually is putting together little bits and pieces of various books in a way that Paul, even if that is a rapture piece in 1 Thessalonians, which I don't think it is, but even if it is, he never would have used it in the sense of the fear of being left behind like the novels are now. This is all new and it's very American. But it's come to dominate our vision to the point that we think this is what the Book of Revelation, quote, means. And there's a whole mini industry of stuff. Go to Mark's sessions on millennialism and you'll get a lot more of this historical, a historian talking about this.
Is this chapter 7 something that the Mormons refer to a lot when they had their relatives sealed to be saved or something like that? Do you remember that?
Boy, I don't know very much about Mormons.
I don't either. I have a cousin who said some of it, he was trying to look us up in the chronology to find us on the list. He said it's probably not sealed.
No, we are sealed. Baptism. I mean, I think this is, Schistler Fiorenza argues very strongly that all this sealing language is meant to invoke baptism memories. That just as Rome, you know, you had to get the mark of the beast, whatever it is, and we'll talk about it. So Christians, the name of God on their forehead, this is, I mean, we say when a child is baptized, you have been marked with the cross of Christ and sealed, no, you've been sealed with the cross of Christ and marked. What is it?
Sealed by the Holy
Spirit. Holy, sealed by the Holy Spirit, marked with the cross of Christ forever. That's it. I haven't done one in a while. But anyway, you are to know that you've been sealed. And we have been sealed. It's just that we forget. You know, Lutherans forget. You know the songs of the apocalypse. You forget you've been sealed. You know, I mean, come on, remember. This is baptismal imagery. You've been sealed. And there's a lot of baptismal stuff through the Book of Revelation. And you've been made a priest. I mean, we also say that in the baptismal liturgy. Welcome, child of God, to the priesthood, something like that, when you give them the candle and stuff. I mean, that every one of you is a priest. It's just that you forget, or we forget, you know, because we don't think in this kind of language. But actually, we've fully been sealed. It's just a different way of reading Revelation from what the fundamentalists, or the Mormons, I guess, read it as. But
Jehovah's Witnesses.
Or Jehovah's Witnesses, yeah, with the fixation on the 144,000 and stuff. I mean, I'm as intimidated as anybody else when those people come knocking at my door. I'm as liable to forget that I've been sealed, you know, because they'll tell me I haven't been, and I, you know, I. But what?
You go on to other things.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's so much fun to counter that notion because the 144,000, the whole point of their thing is to threaten you.
Right.
But you're going to get left, so don't get left. And
yeah.
So you stand there and you say, but I'm not left. How do you know you're not left?
Because I know. I sat on an airplane
with a guy.
It's
so much fun that...
No, it isn't.
It's a kid.
It is? Okay. Well, then I'll leave that evangelical missionary role to you because I hate it. I don't find it fun. But yeah, I mean, the very things of Revelation that are meant to be reassuring, they'll twist as this idea of being left behind. But 140,000, that's 144. It's meant to be numberless, huge, all of us. It's 12 times something. 12 times 12, but with some zeros. 12 times 120 or something.
Yeah.
Something, yeah, 12 times 12. I mean, it's enormous.
Yeah.
So it's meant to include you, of course. And same thing with the rapture. That was not meant to be scaring anybody. They'll be left behind, if indeed that's what Paul's writing about. And there's no rapture in Revelation. We'll talk about that more, this controversial idea. Okay, I got to let you go to coffee break, even though the bell hasn't rung. You don't want to miss your coffee. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.